This week's episode of Lo-Fi Podcast is sponsored by No Wave Academy. For limited time, NoWaveAcademy.com is offering 20% off on all online workshops. That's through this Sunday, February 16th at 11:59 PST. Use discount code NO-February, all caps 20, NO-February 20, all caps to receive 20% off on all online workshops. Their instructors include Steve Kim, Sean Cheatham, Paul Christina, myself, Aaron Westerberg, and many more. Take advantage of this. Again, NO-February 20, all caps through February 16th. Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Lo-Fi Podcast. My name is John Wentz, recording conversations with artists, musicians, and filmmakers from my studio in Paris, France. Before we get started, just one thing to mention. I'd previously said that we were going to be releasing an episode weekly. Slight change to that. Now it's going to be the first 3 weeks of every month. I need 1 week to catch up and, of course, continue to paint. So weeks 1, 2, and 3 of each month, there will be a podcast released. In this episode, I'm recording with my friend Skulk Vandemera, where we discussed growing up in South Africa, the work of Francis Bacon, experiencing art in person versus online, My Bloody Valentine and the importance of music in your studio practice, why it's important to continue working with galleries, and much, much more. This conversation was recorded on January 21st of 2020. Skulk Vandemera is a multidiscipline visual artist. Born and bred in Cape Town, he went on to study graphic design at CPUT. After his studies and fronting indie rock bands, Skulk was headhunted to join advertising hotshop The Jupiter Drawing Room as a junior art director. He left the advertising industry 15 years later as an international award-winning art director and later creative director to pursue his art. Skulk's visceral portraits have a directness about them, yet are underpinned with a tangible fragility. Ambiguous features can morph from immense beauty into utter despair, with hints of the eyes breaking the surface beneath layers of paint, charcoal, turpentine, expressive brushstrokes, and often the physical DNA from the artist's fingertips. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Skulk Vandemera. Hit record off the bat.
Okay.
Cool. Just to keep the, you know, so nothing feels stale. Because usually I find it's like, you go, okay, I'm going to record now, and then everything changes, the whole vibe.
Yeah, then everyone gets stiff. It's kind of like,
yeah, it's like, okay.
It's like, oh, shit, I'm being documented now. It's like, sound intelligent, don't say stupid things, you know, and all that.
Yeah, yeah. Art speak on.
Exactly. Oh God, no. I don't think I'm too familiar with art speak. I try not to, because there's so much blah 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 and nonsense.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't mind it too much. It's one of those things where it's like I wish I was more versed in it. Like, I want to be able to talk about my work, but it's also one of those things that just gets so highly abused that you don't even want to be a part of it. You know what I mean?
I do know
these words that get overused.
Oh God, no, I know. Because for me, I agree with you 100%, because I also often think like, okay, and quite often what I'll do is I'll sit down somewhere and I'll write notes. And because the thing is, when I do Instagram or my website or press releases, I do it all myself. So I've taught myself to try and speak in that sort of like art language, but also try to not be contrived, try to not be pretentious. Just try and be me as much as I can. But I know that there's a certain realm of art speak that it resonates with people, and it's almost like they expect you to speak in those tones and in those words. And I find it a bit of a struggle sometimes, because I just try and keep it as real as possible. So it's something that I'm also working on, and I also wish sometimes that I was a bit more versed and I could. You know, but let's give it a go and see how the art speak goes today.
Man, I'm sure you probably get it a bit, and I completely apologize, but I don't know how to pronounce your name.
Okay, so it's quite simple. It's like, you know, the phrase skulking around. you know, when somebody's lurking in the shadows and you're skulking around. So just take the just take the ing out, and then you've got my name, because that's where the name comes from. It comes from the phrase, the Dutch phrase, which is like, I think I looked it up, and my own name means kind of like sort of like a deviant person, you know, somebody that's lurking around and skulking around, and that's where my name comes from.
So so it is a hard CH, it's not sh, it's skulk.
No, yeah, no, it's a hard CH, and yeah, so just take the ing out, and then you've got my name. That's the best way I can explain it to people, because Americans, yo, they get my name so wrong.
Yeah, we're terrible.
No, you're not terrible. It's just a weird name. It's kind of like, well, how do you? I've been called Scott. I've been called Scar. I've been called many things, you know. So I just respond to any of the above. It's kind of, yeah.
But I find with Americans, if it's anything outside of John Smith, we just stumble on our words.
Is that where you're from originally, John? Are you from the States?
Yeah, I'm from San Francisco. I'm West Coast.
Oh, fantastic. My wife was there two years ago, and she absolutely loved it. She said San Francisco was an incredible place. So I haven't been there. I've been to New York, and I've been to Chicago, but I haven't been to on the West Coast yet, and that's definitely something that the two of us want to do together, go up to the Redwoods. I want to go see those big, beautiful things. I would love to go to San Francisco.
Yeah, and do it now before it completely changes.
Oh, is it about to change? Why? What's changing?
Well, with the whole tech explosion, I mean, San Francisco now, for somebody who's a native, it's nothing like it was, say, like in, you know, the 90s, even into the early 2000s. Uh-huh. With the tech explosion, I mean, the rents, it's one of the most expensive places to live in the U.S. And with the rise of it, unfortunately, the price is going up. It's pushed a lot of the creatives out. So the things, my opinion, is the things that really made San Francisco charming.
Yeah.
You know, like music venues, artists, musicians, it's all but dead at this point.
That's quite sad.
But there's still a lot of great things to see. But it is sad. It's very sad.
It's very sad because, I mean, if you go back to, you know, like the 60s, I mean, that was the hub of like the whole flower power thing. And then from there, it just grew.
Oh, yeah.
It became this melting pot of like interesting, exciting, edgy, almost like zero judgment, where everyone could just be themselves, you know, and express themselves. So, yeah, it's a pity when, you know, capitalism starts stepping in and the culture and the place starts changing. It's sad when that starts happening, you know. And unfortunately, the creatives, you're right. You know, when places become that expensive, then, yeah, a lot of artists can't afford to be there. They just have to go find a different place.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I have this weird thing now I've only developed in the last few years where I try to see the other side of the coin on all situations. And it's sad, but then it's like change is inevitable. And as terrible as it is, I mean, that's one of the reasons I moved out. And as terrible as that is, but there's going to be places now that will flourish with artists. And I think that's a pretty great thing. So they're moving to cheaper areas. So now in time, maybe 10 years, you'll start to see these artistic communities, a community of artists in other areas that maybe they weren't there before.
And where do you think in America that's going to start happening? Because, yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful way to... Yeah,
Paris.
Yeah,
and not Texas.
Yeah, not the same place. No, not at all. Geez, man, I would. Yeah, Paris. Oh, I love that city. We were there my wife and I were there in October after my solo show in London. We went to Paris for a couple of days, and God, we love that city. I mean, it is.
Was it your first time?
No, second time. And
okay.
And everything about that place, you know, the art, the history, the culture, the food, the wine, the people, because I love French people. I think they're fantastic, you know. If I could live there, I would live there in a heartbeat. I think it's so filled with just creativity and energy. And I love the place. I think it's absolutely one of my favorite places in the world. Absolutely beautiful.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you have to come again so we can hang out.
I would definitely love to do that. How long have you been in Paris for?
I'm about, well, it's 2.5 years, but it was kind of off and on because I had to do a lot of visa stuff. So I would say altogether just under 2 years.
Okay. And is that now permanent for you? Do you think you're going to settle in Paris and stay there, or are you going to move around?
That's what I'm working on. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm working on a permanent residency in, which is perfect. The other thing here, I mean, as an American, you know, the U.S. is so large, and I mean, I'm kind of ashamed to admit, like I haven't done much time in Europe, you know, prior to that. So the geography, man, it's like the perfect home base.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask you about that because kind of my wife and I spoke about that probably a couple of months ago. We spoke about long-term goals, you know, and for me, as much as I love being South African and I see myself as an African, you know, it's wonderful living here. We've got a great lifestyle, but the problem is I'm sitting at the bottom end of Africa, which is, in a way, you're quite disconnected.
You're in Cape Town, right?
Yeah, I mean, just outside Cape Town, yeah, in Hout Bay, which is like a small little fishing village just outside Cape Town, probably about 10 kilometers outside of Cape Town. And it's great because it's got all those beautiful benefits of like wide open spaces. 2 hours drive and I'm in the desert. Another 2 hours drive, I'm in the winelands. Another 2 hours drive, I'm
in... Oh, that's amazing.
So it's got like incredible diversity in what it has to offer. And I love the people. Obviously, I've lived here my whole life. But from an art career point of view, for me, I think being more centralized in places like Paris or London or Berlin or any of those kind of places, to me just feels more like a creative fit for me. And especially with my work as well, you know, here in South Africa, most people are scared by my work. You know, they you know, they think that, you know, is this guy like a Satanist? Is he, you know, is he, what's wrong with him? Is he depressed?
When you say that, you're being quite literal, right? Because I know there is a lot of, I don't know the right word to put it. I mean, I don't want to say crazy, but there, some of the things that I've read about, you know, people's beliefs, they take that stuff very seriously. And very
absolutely. In South Africa. Yeah, you know what? I think people are quick to point fingers at other parts of the world, you know, like America, and they'll go like, you know, they, with the current administration, things are going backwards and people are so conservative. But I mean, I come from a history of, you know, apartheid South Africa, which was, if you want to talk conservatism, I mean, that was the pinnacle of that. It was all about that. I mean, the country was ruled by the National Party and the church. And those two entities were incredibly conservative, you know, and they were scared of change. And I think that that philosophy has kind of like permeated its way into our culture. So there's still a lot of people that when they see a work of art that moves them or that challenges them or that doesn't look pretty as they would expect it to look, you know, then they get scared. They project their own stuff onto the painting, and in this case, my work, and they see it as dark or evil. And I'm like, well, that's not really the point. You know, that's not what I'm trying to do. I think that is just because of the past and because of the way people have been brought up. I don't hold it against them. You know, I don't even get angry or upset when people say these things. I just find like, well, that's your projection onto my work, because that is definitely not the intention. And that's not what I'm trying to say or do with my work. But if you see that, well, good for you. That's what you see, you know. I think it's just, I think it's a cultural thing, you know. And I think we find that kind of conservatism around the world, where people are just, anything that's different, they get scared. You know, it's like, oh God, I expect a painting to be beautiful, or I expect a beautiful landscape, or I need to recognize what I'm looking at. But as soon as it starts moving them on a visceral level or on an emotional level, and they kind of feel uncomfortable, you know, then people, they tend to go to the default button, which happens to just be always like dark, evil, scary, morbid, all those kind of things. And, but I've grown accustomed to that by now. You know, for me, it's, I'm okay with that. I don't really mind it. You know, at least it gets a reaction out of people, which I think is a good thing.
Right. Do you think it's anything that's been kind of a driving force behind your work? Because I find sometimes like really art that interests me, I guess maybe, I find is always has like a contrarian aspect to it. And I mean that in like the nicest way possible.
Absolutely. You know, I think if I can go back again to kind of my childhood and growing up in South Africa in the sort of 70s and 80s, because the government at the time was pretty much a regime that controlled this country in every possible way. I mean, they controlled what we could read, what we could watch, what we could listen to. Everything was censored. So therefore, there was this element of like, you're not allowed to explore. You're not allowed to be yourself. You're not allowed to try different things, because this is the way we want you to behave. Be in your box, stay in your box. And I think it's actually 30 years later now with my art and stuff, now that I can reflect and look back on it as a grown man, I can look at this and kind of go like, those were actually good things in a weird, ironic kind of way, because it forced me to find my own identity. It forced me to find the truth as well, because back in those days, we were lied to all the time by the church and the government and even our communities. You know, people kind of like didn't know. So they were feeding you bullshit and they were feeding you the same lies over and over. So that in a way made me go, okay, well, I don't want to be like this. I don't believe what you're telling me. So I've got to find my own truth. And that in itself, I think, became contrary in that if everyone's going that way, well, I want to go a different way. I want to do things differently. And thank goodness I had parents, even though they were, you know, they came from a conservative background, they realized, I think, from a young age that this one's different. And we just need to let him grow and we need to let him bloom and we'll guide him and give him good morals. But in terms of what he's going to do and what he's going to say, that we cannot and will not control. So I'm actually quite grateful for them for allowing me to, yeah, just express myself from a very young age, just be myself. So, yeah, so I think for me, work that has a point of view that is not deliberately trying to be different, but at least you can look at it and go, there's truth in that work. There's something in it that moves me. I'm always attracted to that kind of work. You know, that's why I love somebody like Francis Bacon. You know, I'm a huge fan. I saw his work at the George Pompidou in October, his exhibition there. And
Of Bacon. I'm sorry, I cut out for a second there. Yeah. Did you say Bacon?
Yeah, I saw.
Yeah, I just went to that show the other day.
And what did you think?
I thought it was phenomenal.
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, what was, oh man, I was in absolute awe, you know, and I found it incredibly emotional. And what I found fascinating is that having gone to the Louvre, where you have a million selfies being taken every 2 seconds, it was, I mean, that was madness. Going to that exhibition, the whole room and the whole exhibition was quiet. It was introspective. There was like a soft murmur in the room. Nobody spoke. Nobody took selfies. It was almost like his work demanded you to stop, look, take it in, self-reflect, and then move on. You know, so it was, I thought it was, to me, it was kind of like a spiritual experience, because I just think that his work is phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. And I agree too, because they had so many triptychs in there. For me, at least, I think triptychs, they always have a religious feel to me, some kind of spiritual feeling after seeing them, a lot of them in cathedrals,
yeah.
You know, like a multi-panel thing. And the way that it was curated and set up really felt that way to me as well. And I was surprised that actually it was in one of the first rooms. There was one person who was actually on like FaceTime or something, showing their friends where they're at.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I seen somebody get chided by a crowd. Like everybody's like, shh, you know,
really?
Telling her to get off her goddamn phone. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it was amazing. Because, yeah, you don't see that at the Louvre. The Louvre, to me, has become like a meme into itself.
It's true. Its
own self-contained type of thing. It's like, even just the pyramid outside, you know, you see when you walk there, you see all the people doing their selfies and putting their finger on top of the pyramid. And Pompidou, I think it demands a little bit more respect than the Louvre does.
Absolutely. But listen, I mean, I understand that there's, you know, there's people want to see these works. But I guess the thing that bugs me about the selfies, I don't have any issue with if you're going to take a selfie because you're in a beautiful place. But then at least turn around and spend another 5 minutes looking at the artwork that you just stood in front of. It's almost like people are just...
Exactly, yeah.
They're just recording the fact that they were at the Louvre and they stood in front of the Mona Lisa or in front of a beautiful Raphael or whatever it might be. But there's no interaction. It's almost like, for me, I almost want to say to these people, do you realize that you're being incredibly disrespectful to this artist, this man or woman, whoever spent months, years creating this work, honing their craft, and all you can do is take a picture of your fucking face in front of this incredible painting, you know? It's like...
Yeah, the snap and go.
Yeah, the snap and go. That's exactly what it is, you know? So, yeah, so the Bacon show to me was just, it was mind-blowing. It was absolutely incredible. And, yeah, a life-changing experience to see. But especially seeing it up close, you know, that for me is always the best way to truly experience art is if you can, because I mean, Instagram and online and photographs only do works justice so much, you know, there's not a,
yeah,
you know, you, But when you're standing up close, you can smell the paint and you can see the brush strokes and the movement and the energy in the work. That's the thing that moves me. And yeah, so I thought that exhibition was exceptional.
Yeah, there was a piece that I can't remember the title of it, but that really got me back into that mind frame of experiencing art in person, which I do all the time here. I mean, I feel so forward. The other things, I'm surrounded by some of the best museums in the world, and I can go any day. But I was looking at a part where I can't remember the painting, but you could see this passage that he painted where there was a light color. It was like around the thigh of a figure, and then after it dried, he like scumbled a dark red over that passage.
Yeah.
And that really hit me because it's something you wouldn't see online because the image would be far too small. And it really put me back in the mind frame of what I'm seeing right now is a record of somebody thinking.
Yeah.
Because that was after the painting had dried.
Yeah.
He obviously took a look at it and was like, for some reason, whatever, this is not working. And he put another mark down. And yeah, that is such, I mean, we're living in a time, I feel like, with the experience of art, we're only at half of it.
Yeah.
Because with these images that we see online, like I learned once from somebody about this idea of impact and payoff in painting. Or it seems like a painting, the first thing is the impact, and that's what catches you from a distance, right? The painting, it's small. And then that wants you to get closer, and then that experience of being closer is the payoff.
Yeah.
And so I feel like we're just living in this era of impact.
Yeah. So true. It's almost like we are like voyeuristic when it comes to the art. You know, we are looking at it from afar, but we're not actually experiencing that wonderful thing that you saw with that painting, which is, oh man, that's special when you, because also like being an artist, I mean, you know that you do a painting and then you step back and you kind of go, that blue or that line doesn't work. And then you, and you go back, or, you know, you take something out. And for me, I always think like, okay, so what was going through his head at that time? Why didn't he not like that color? Why? What was it? And I love that fact because it's almost like you're standing next to him at that moment, you know, where he has that moment of doubt or he has that moment of clarity to go, nope, it can't be orange. It should be blue, you know, and that's a special thing, you know, and I think the digital age doesn't allow us to, you know, to do those kind of things and experience those kind of things. And I always try and say to people like, listen, no matter if it's my work or your work or Dan's work or, you know, if it's Bacon or whoever, Picasso, doesn't matter. If you can go and see somebody's work in person, please do. Do not look at it online and think that you've got an understanding of what that person is doing or tried to do or their technique. Because up close, you have a completely different perspective and experience of who that artist is. You know, there's detail in there, like you said, that you won't see online. And that's sad. You know, for me, that's sad that... But I mean, yeah, I guess, like you said, you're lucky you're in Paris. You know, you can go walk down the street and you've got amazing museums. But a lot of people don't have that that luxury.
Exactly. And I fully understand that. But I think going back to what you're saying, like the people taking selfies, the other danger of that is what it's doing is, in of course, outside of painting as well, is the world is becoming less more about experience and more about social media fodder. It's just some things are things to put online now. And that's the thing that really scares me when I see that in museums. Like you were saying, it's like this thing, even aside, you know, take the labor side out of it. This is created to promote or evoke an experience. Mm-hmm. And now it has become nothing more than fodder to put online.
That's it. And what is the fodder for? It's just there so that you can get more likes, more followers, whatever it might be.
Yeah, attention.
Basically just pure attention, you know, and it's self-gratifying. That's all it is. And you're so right, you know, because for me, that thing is that, how can I explain it? It's I don't have a problem with online stuff. I mean, you and I are both on Instagram and I understand the value and I understand why it's there and I use it myself.
Right.
But for me, there's a time and a place. And I think when you are in the presence of greatness and you're in the presence of people that did paintings 200 years ago, 300 years ago, and these paintings are telling a story of that time and what they were going through and maybe war or social change or whatever it is, then I think it deserves more respect than just, like you say, you know, digital fodder where it's just being posted, because it takes all that meaning and specialness away. And I know I'm sounding like an old guy now, because people are like, yeah, but you're old and you don't understand. It's like, no, I get it. I understand why it's there.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
But at the same time, I also think that, yeah, a lot of like missed opportunities to really engage with something and hopefully be moved by it, you know, in a profound way. And when you're standing in front of Bacon, I don't want to take selfies in front of Bacon. I want to feel his pain. I want to feel that torment. And that for me is very special. Have you seen his documentary called The Brush with Violence?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
My
It's fantastic.
God. I mean, that gave me such incredible insight into the man. And wow. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff there, and you can see that in the work. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of stuff.
You definitely can. Yeah,
yeah, and that's what I love about his work is the fact that I think he was the first really honest painter that just went like, you know what, I've got a lot of shit that I've got to deal with. I've got a lot of like personal problems, and I'm going to put it on the canvas and I'm going to show it to the world. And I think that was an incredibly brave thing to do, because I mean nobody else was doing that at the time. And yeah. I think genius.
Yeah, he was in a bubble of his own. Yeah. But you know, something with that documentary and thinking back to the exhibition, because you remember the end of the exhibition in that final room, they have like a diorama mm-hmm. of the studio.
Yeah.
And this also harkens back to what you're talking about growing up in Cape Town, is it really made me reconsider environment. Because lately, I don't know, I think being in Paris, I'm kind of going through this thing where trying, and I've been reading a lot of like art philosophy and trying to kind of comprehend like the role of artist. Mm. And of course it's multi-level. So one I'm interested in is like artist as conduit, you know, expressing, taking in the things around you and expressing those. Mm-hmm. And what it really reminded me of his diorama is I felt that like he built this kind of cocoon for himself that was a reflection of his inside. Cause I mean, his studio is so disgusting. Dank, and there were, you know, in the documentary, there's shit everywhere on the floor, and just it's a mess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he maybe it's like you create this kind of womb mm-hmm. or cocoon that's, you know, it helped him create what he did. And you know, because I think that's a documentary as well where he's going through like a bottle of wine, right?
Yep,
that's as he's the one. Doing the interview.
That's the
and
one
he's drinking. Yeah, and you see that darkness unfold the drunker he gets, and I just wonder, like, he's all, you know, do you think that is a role in creating art? Because that, again, that kind of reminds me of what you're talking about growing up in South Africa. There's this kind of like friction that needs to be there to create something.
Absolutely. I think it's essential. And for me, I think to answer your question in two parts, I mean, first of all, like the studio space and kind of thing that I've got quite a small, humble place that I work in. And I'm about to extend it and get like a bigger space and stuff like that, because I feel my works are getting bigger and I just want more space so I can start doing some sculpting, etc., etc. So I want to start playing around with different mediums and that kind of stuff as well. But I think that for 6 years, my studio has been, like you said, like a cocoon. It's my safe space. I go in there and the world outside, even though it influences me, it's got an impact on what I do, how I think, how I behave. When I'm in there, it is entirely me by myself with canvases, and there's no interference. You know, I have my music playing, but there's no noise coming in from the outside, be it through the computer or the news or the television or the radio or anything like that. So I think that space, in a way, is a reflection of the artist, but I think that space also then reflects in the work and what people do. So I think that that's very, very important. And then with regards to, you know, like being a conduit and being influenced by the things that we have, because when people say to me, like, my work is dark and why do I paint these things? I kind of go like, well, a lot of people kind of forget what South Africa really was like in the 70s and 80s. I mean, I was lucky and privileged enough that I was born white in South Africa. So that gave me a huge amount of privilege. But there was a dark side and an underbelly mm-hmm. to our country for decades that nobody spoke about, that was there. It was this uneasy energy, this monster lurking in the shadows. And everyone knew it was there, but it was just never dealt with because it was easier to just kind of move along, live your life, do your things. But as a child growing up, I had a very clear intuition that something was wrong. And I also had a very clear feeling that I was being lied to. So all that stuff somewhere got stored in my subconscious, in my mind, in my spiritual being. And over time, as I started doing the work that I'm doing now, a lot of that stuff started coming out. So things that happened 30, 40 years ago, all of a sudden was emerging in my work. You know, issues around the church, issues around dogma and religion, issues around apartheid and racism, all that kind of stuff. Because it was kind of like suppressed for so many years that sooner or later it had to find an outlet. It had to find a way of expressing itself. And I guess that I'm lucky that I can express it in my work and not through abusive behavior or, you know, turning into a racist myself or something like that. At least I sort of said to myself, well, if you've got these feelings and you've got these issues and these scars and these traumatic events that happen in your life, then find an expressive and a constructive way to get it out to the world. You know, and so I think that all of those circumstances, if you're open to it and you can accept it for what it is and not turn it into a story or being a victim or feeling sorry for yourself, if you can take it and say, like, right, here they are, they're not pleasant, they're uncomfortable, but get it out. You'd rather get it on a canvas, rather get it on a piece of paper than just harboring this negativity that eventually I think in our country became a cancer, and it became something that a lot of people from my generation today, they struggle with, because things have changed so dramatically in South Africa that a lot of people don't really know where they fit in now. Where's my place? Where's my role? Because for so long, you know, the white people in South Africa dominated this country and ruled this country. And now the pendulum is kind of swinging, and it has to swing for things to balance out again. So there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of resentment. And somebody's got to paint that. You know, I think there's enough people painting landscapes and sunsets. So somebody's got to paint that shit and get it out there and say to people, like, well, this is us. You know, this is part of our, all of us, like part of our collective consciousness. We've got to get this out there. And, you know, and I'm not a political person. I don't think my work, I've got ideas around stuff that I want to do about that time in my life. But I think if you're going to go political, and you need to make sure that you know both sides of the story. I think you need to be very clear about what your message is, because it's a minefield, you know. And if you go out there with a naive statement or a naive point of view, or a very one-sided point of view, I think that would be sacrilege, and it would be wrong, you know, to do something like that. So I'm mindful.
But I think yeah. And it's difficult too, I think, with politics, because I mean, aside from like some of the bigger issues we've seen in the world that, you know, you can't argue, like, you know, the Holocaust or things like that.
Yes.
It's often, there's two sides to a story. I find. And so I have a hard time with political art, because I feel like, no, even if I agree with it, it's still propaganda.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's always a dot, but like things like apartheid, of course not. Like that, there's no dialogue there.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I think I kind of feel the same way with political art. I think it's better that most of it doesn't promote discussion, in my opinion. Whereas I think outside of that with art, you can promote a discussion.
That's a very good point. I agree with you 100%. You know, that's actually an excellent point. The fact that when you look at an artwork, you're just getting that perspective, but there's no context. So if the artist is there, well, then you can have a discussion with him. You can talk about him, like, well, where does this come from? What is it about? And that person might give you a completely different point of view or perspective on what you've created. But you're so right. When it's just a piece of art or an installation or a conceptual piece or a sculpture, whatever, it is quite one-dimensional in that sense, you know. And where's the flip side to that? So that's why even though I come from a very political background where there was politics was such an essential part of an unfortunate part of my upbringing, I don't really want to go there. You know, I also don't want to labor on the past. You know, I don't want to be too much in, well, let me tell you about how I thought things went, and let me tell you this. It's like, well, you know, some of the stuff has been dealt with, but I think, yeah, you're right. Discussion is a much better thing where you can sit and have dialogue, like proper dialogue with people about what happened to them, what are their stories, and listen rather than tell. You know, I think that's a much more powerful, powerful thing to do than prescribe and kind of go, well, this is my, like you said, my propaganda. This is what I believe is the right thing. And yeah, so I'd rather steer clear of that kind of thing. But environment, upbringing, social community, I think it plays a massive part in people's art, you know, and the energy that gets put into that art. I think it's, yeah, I think it's essential for every artist to be open to that and tap into that.
Yeah. And what kept you there? I mean, it obviously wasn't an easy thing, place to grow up in. And of course, you came to a point in your life where you could have left.
Yeah. Because I love this country. It's, you know, for me, it's, because there was in sort of like the early 90s when the ANC was disbanded, not illegal anymore. They, a lot of people, and when I say people, a lot of white people got very scared. They thought it was going to be chaos and there was going to be, you know, like fighting in the streets, which we had for years anyway. So a lot of people thought like, well, the best option is to pack up and leave. And I've always had the philosophy, well, if we all leave, and then who's going to fix the country? Who's going to take the country forward, you know? And for me, it's not always that the grass is greener on the other side. You kind of go like, oh, I'll go to Australia, or I'll go to the UK, or I'll go to America. But those countries have got their own problems, you know? They've got similar issues under different names. And for me, it was always just like, I love this country. It's given me everything that I have. And so for me, it was never an option to escape it or to run away from it. The only thing that I knew that I could do was, as an adult, I could behave differently. As an adult, I could make different choices in how I treat people, what I do, how I live my life. And yeah, that's my way of contributing to the country. And rather than, you know, step away from it and kind of go like, well, that never happened. I'll just go and find something else somewhere else. So that was never an option for me.
That's interesting. So you, that kind of pushed you into doing kind of an internal dialogue, like you're saying, the things you can do as just an individual, act differently, treat people differently.
Yeah.
What do you think contributes to that? Because that's something that I think is a rare thing, especially like when, and it's nothing what you've experienced, but when I see the politics in America right now, that's not part of the mentality. It's not like I could change, I could do something different. What, do you think is it part of the privilege of being white in Africa? I mean, what contributes to that mentality?
I think it's about taking responsibility and for your own actions and for being truthful about what happened, you know. So don't try and justify things and kind of go like, oh, well, you should see it from this way or you should see it from that way. It's kind of going like, okay, well, look at the reality, look at what happened. But I think to bring change about within yourself, I think, is a hard thing to do. And I can only speak from my experience in South Africa, but to self-reflect and really look in the mirror and kind of go like, okay, well, this is who I am, and what don't I like about myself? What can I improve about myself? Takes a lot of seriously hard work, and it takes a lot of spiritual work, where you actually have to, even if you go to a therapist, but you've got to start looking on the inside, because I think too many people want to find the problem outside of the tent. You know, it's kind of like, oh, no, it's out there. Those people, he made me do it. She made me do it. The circumstances made me do it. And as an adult man, I realized that, well, I have a choice in how I behave. I have a choice in how I think and the way I treat people, the way I treat the environment. So for me, it was like a very conscious decision to go and do workshops, to go and do spiritual workshops, where it was like, okay, let's look at my shit. What is it? How do I deal with it? And how do I hopefully improve it? And it's work in progress. You know, I still make stupid mistakes. Mm-hmm. I still do things that I sometimes cringe when I say things or I do things that I think like, wow, man, you could have treated that person better and you could have handled that situation better. But that's life, you know, and that's, I guess, that's part of our evolution as a species, hopefully. So I think that, but also if that kind of thing isn't promoted by mainstream media or the governments of the world, where it's about look at yourself first.
No, of course not. Yeah.
You know, if your leaders aren't leading by example, then how can you expect the people to kind of one day have an awakening and go, oh, I should, you know, like Gandhi said, be the change you want to be. It's kind of like very few people will go there because ignorance is bliss. My life is good. I'm happy. Why should I change? You know? And so I think, yeah, it has to be a conscious thing, in my opinion, that you actually kind of get real about things and try and make a difference, you know, and yeah, you're going to make
it. Yeah, it doesn't happen by accident, not usually.
No. That kind of thing, when you have to really, really look hard at yourself, I don't think that happens by accident. I think you might be fortunate to meet a person that can open a door for you or show you a different way, but then you still have to be prepared to walk through that door. You know, the door's just going to be open, but if you don't step through the door wall, then nothing's going to happen. No change is going to happen. So, yeah, it's hard work, man. It's hard work.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to look at yourself in the mirror.
Yeah.
For sure.
But, yeah, to be conscientious is tough, you know, because it comes with a lot of responsibility. But it's a cool challenge, and I try. I try every day to just be better and treat people better and treat the world around me better, and hopefully my small part makes a difference. We'll have to wait and see.
Do you think something like that becomes any easier for an artist? And I'm really putting a blanket over the term artist, but like in terms of self-reflection, because I find like, I mean, it's hard to get outside of your head, but we spend so many hours with this other thing in front of us, mm-hmm. you know, a canvas or a sculpture, and like it or not, that thing is a mirror, and we're constantly critiquing it and we're battling it and, you know, hating this decision we made, enjoying this decision we made. So sometimes I wonder if it's like, maybe it actually makes it a little bit easier for someone with that type of outlet to have any type of self-reflection. You know, you think about somebody else who doesn't have that, who maybe mm-hmm. just has their day job that they're not that happy with, you know, this and that. It's harder to make that change to that. And I'm not trying to like glorify an artist. I'm just saying we're used to critiquing ourselves in a way.
Yeah.
The most of us.
I think so. I think, but like you said in the beginning, you know, like I also don't want to generalize. I kind of feel like, oh, well, you know, we're a special breed and we, but I think that.
I don't mean it like that. Yeah. I hate that stuff. We're not special.
No. We are.
But I mean, it's just that act. We're not special in what we do, but that act of what I find, you know, because I've done, like in trying to better myself, I've done other things like you as well, like therapy and this and that. And I found some of those things were easier for me because I'm used to critiquing myself. Mm-hmm. So it's just that act of it. The act of making art, I don't really think is that special. Not special in that sense. But the act of critiquing yourself on a daily basis is something that others don't have that opportunity to do. So it's more of an opportunity than it is to me like this innate thing, you know?
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think because we are more, my wife told me or taught me a word a while back, being an empath, which is like you are, she said to me, you're very susceptible and open to what happens around you. And I don't know if it's a character trait. I don't know if it's like certain people have it, but I have seen a lot more of that with creative people. I think there's a part of our, I don't know if it's part of our heart or part of our head, but there's a part of us, like you say, that is prepared to look at something and accept it for what it is, not to try and change it. You know, kind of go like, okay, well, that is what it is. And you're so right about the canvas being a mirror. And over the last 6 years, I mean, I've seen stuff in the mirror that I've been disappointed in, you know, stuff in the mirror that I've been scared of, stuff in the mirror that inspired me, positive and negative, you know, things that are there. And I think that mirror is like always looking back at us and we're always looking at it. So I think that you're right that it's easier for us to embrace that kind of thing because we are accustomed to it. We are accustomed to kind of go like, well, is that good enough? Is this good enough? Can I push it further? Should I be more experimental? Should I do all those kind of things? But having said that, for me, I always try to, when I go into my studio, I think about my art a lot. So I'll look after I've done something and I'll analyze and I'll kind of go like, what could I have done better? Because there's always improvement. You know, you can always improve something here or there or the whole bloody thing sometimes. But For me, it's always I try to take the cognitive process out of it. So when I go into the studio and I put on my music and I start painting or drawing, I switch my mind off completely. And I just paint from a place that comes from within. So it's got no judgment. It's got no expectation. It's got no rules of what I can or cannot do. And that for me is amazing in the sense that that also allows me to tap into things that if I had to think about it too much, I probably wouldn't want to go there. So if it's stuff that is that is dark or difficult or negative, my brain will kind of go, you can deal with that later in a different way. Whereas when I go through the process that I go through in my studio, there are no filters. There are no barriers in terms of you cannot do this, you shouldn't do that. It's paint what you feel. Paint what you're experiencing right now at that moment. And don't worry about the outcome, because I think as soon as I start thinking about the outcome, that's when you start becoming inhibited. And I think that kind of thinking, to your point, is something then that allows me to, when I have to do self-reflection and stuff, it's easier for me to do that because I don't have those filters and those walls up to go, I need to protect myself. I can't go here. I can't go there. But that stuff is also the kind of thing that, yeah, man, it sometimes drives me mad. And it takes you into places that is very uncomfortable. I mean, you know, as an artist yourself, we spend so much time by ourselves in solitude and isolation. And I know a lot of artists, and I've been through it myself, where by exploring and being open to experience those things, it also borders on the thing of alienation and depression and, you know, being excluded and all those kind of emotions, all those kind of feelings start coming up. And that can also be a dangerous place because that can easily just lead to, like, you know, self-pity or substance abuse or all those kind of things, because people struggle to cope because they're it's almost like they open up this portal of honesty where it's just, okay, all the shit, the good and the bad, is just going to get poured out and you're going to have to deal with it by yourself in your studio with a canvas and a brush. And yeah, I think that can be a hard thing. So I think having a space where you can go, like, on a retreat where you can do spiritual work or speak to a therapist, I think those things are good, you know, to have a place where somebody else can just go, it's okay. It's not as bad. Right. It's not as bad.
Yeah. To your point, I think that's an interesting thing because, you know, it's funny. It kind of harkens to, like, the stereotype of the depressed artist.
Yeah.
And people see that as, like, the cart and the horse, you know, in, like, popular culture. It's like artists are usually depressed and that's why they need to express themselves. But I always wonder if that's actually, you're putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
Because the process of art and making, that isolation mixed with maybe insecurities of what you're doing and kind of, like, you know, digging into yourself, you have to face yourself, maybe expressing these things. And then afterwards, not having any type of roadmap to navigate that will actually lead to depression. I mean, and that's outside of, like, you know, we're talking about chemical imbalances. That's an entirely different thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But not having that after, because then it's kind of assumed that, like, the making of the art is the end of that journey. It's like, you know, you did this, like, Joseph Campbell hero's journey thing. And it's like, no, that's not quite it. You've opened up something that has no roadmap. And it's like, now how do I deal with this? And how do I deal with the isolation? So, you know, like you're saying, I agree. Like, afterwards, like, whatever your thing is, if it's a spiritual retreat, if it's therapy, you need a way to cope, I think, with all of those things. And unfortunately, I think what you've seen with a lot of artists in the past is coping was getting notoriety, perhaps. And then that emptiness, because that wasn't the answer, will lead to things like substance abuse or whatnot.
Absolutely. But I think you've hit the nail on the head with the thing of, like, you know, it's, you need somebody to help you navigate this roadmap, because once you open up that can of worms, it's like, I mean, most of us always think that we, you know, well, I know that I thought that you can deal with these things by yourself. You know, you can, oh, I'm fine. You know, I can deal with it. But when you're painting for a period of, like, say, a year, and you're working on a body of work, a year is a long time to self-reflect. A year is a long time to, yes, you know, to sit in a studio and just look in the mirror. And yeah, and it's about reaching out and kind of go like, okay, well, that's not my skill level. I've opened these things up. I can express them in a creative way. But now I've still got to live in the real world. I've still got to cope. I've still got to, man, what do I do with all these emotions that have come up? Because you've done 20 paintings, but there's still another 100 paintings in issues that you still have to explore that you haven't done yet. And I think for me, what I've learned very quickly is that I need people that I can talk to. I need people that can be objective, right, that can give me perspective, you know, because if you just go into this quagmire and into this labyrinth of stuff, and most of us don't get taught these things when we were younger, you know, you don't get taught. I wish they would at schools, instead of teaching kids religion, I wish they would teach them about spirituality, about, you know, meditation and self-reflection and how you deal with yourself first. Because I never got those tools, you know, and I'm lucky enough that I'm married to a woman who is very spiritual, and she's done a heap of workshops and amazing work. So she can be a bouncing ball for me, but only up to a point. Then I still need to find other people to kind of like, sometimes, for lack of a better phrase, balance the madness, you know, because otherwise you, mm-hmm, you start believing your own bullshit, and you start believing that nobody gets you and that you're by yourself and you're not understood. And that's, I think, to your point, it's like, you know, then it's the work comes first, and then the issues like the depression and the alienation, and, you know, that comes afterwards, because you've basically scratched the surface, and all of a sudden you find, oh my God, the more I dig, the deeper the hole, you know. But at the same time, for me, it's the only way I know how. I don't really know. I can't see myself just at this point in my career. I can't see myself painting still lives. I can't see myself. I know technically
pastoral landscapes.
I don't think so, John. It's, you know what it is? It doesn't feed my soul. That's the thing, because I came from, 12 to 15 years of advertising, right? So I was a creative director in advertising. Mm-hmm. And so I know all about not feeding your soul. I know all about answering the brief and doing the job and keeping people happy and justifying everything that you do. And for me, I don't want to go back to that place. For me, it's about, this is me, and if you relate to it, that's fantastic. If you don't, that's also okay, because somebody else will. But ultimately, it's just my truth. That's all it is. It's just my truth. It's my creative journey, and I have to be as truthful as possible that I can to that journey, because, yeah, I don't want to sell people bullshit. I don't want to paint paintings to make other people happy. You know, I need to be happy first. And I think hopefully that will then resonate with other people, and they can see themselves or part of themselves in that work. And if that happens, and I can just change somebody to kind of like say like, oh, I need to go and look at this, man, then I've achieved so much. And that would make me extremely happy if I can do that to people.
Yeah, there's the power of communication is an amazing thing. And visual communication, I think, in particular, when somebody can relate to something that you've done in isolation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really nothing that compares to it.
Yeah, no, it's you know, well, it's like a, I know this phrase gets overused, but it's a blessing. It really is a blessing, you know. And on the one thing, a good thing about Instagram is that I get, so often I get messages from people talking about my work and what it's done for them. And it's so humbling when somebody that you've never met that sits in Iran or in somewhere in a small town in America or in Australia or in Russia, and the work or that piece gave them hope, or it gave them some kind of insight into who they are, and or it's just encouraged them to pick up a brush and start painting. Man, that's a humbling thing, and for me it's a blessing, you know, that at least with Instagram there is some good in it as well. You know, it's not all just self-gratifying. There is, you know, it can actually hopefully make a difference in some people's lives. And so we're lucky that we get to do this, you know, that we can hopefully move people. What a privilege, man. It's an incredible thing.
Yeah. And like you said too, the time in which to do it. So I know, like you, I mean, we all complain about Instagram and algorithms and all this stuff, and there's a lot of crap that's come of it, but you know, and you know this as well, is we remember, this is the okay boomer moment, but remember like the time before Instagram, mm-hmm. I remember making art before the internet.
Yeah.
And it was difficult. And talk about not having control.
Yeah.
You know, your work, you were literally at the, you know, almost literally at the whim of galleries, mm-hmm. if you wanted to get your work seen. And that's funny, because in doing this, like that, when I'm talking to artists now, that's been another one of the common threads, is just this kind of empowering feeling, and not just empowering, but a gratifying feeling of being able to directly communicate with people.
Yeah, I think it's,
whereas, and that's usually coming from people I've talked to that remember what it was like before.
Yeah. Because I mean,
it was a very strange thing to not be able to show your artwork before.
Yep. Because you're so right. It's like, you're almost like completely relinquishing power to someone else, and you don't know how that person's going to sell your work. You don't know how that person's going to talk about your work. So I think that's, I mean, I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship with Instagram, because I know that it's...
Oh, of course.
I kind of know, I'm quite clear about what it's there for me, and it's kind of like getting my work out there, because just having access to millions of eyes, which include gallerists, curators, collectors, art fans, people, that is, I mean, what an incredible thing. Having also been in advertising, I know how much money it takes to build a brand. And if you want to build a brand globally,
right, with your background, yeah.
To build a brand globally takes millions. I mean, it is a huge, huge expense to get something that people go like, ooh, I want a part of that. Whereas now you upload a photograph and a click away, and there you have it. You know, you've got access to all these people. So I think it's like, I use it with that in mind. You know, for me, it's not about selling art or for people. Mm-hmm. It's because I never would buy a piece of art if I see it on Instagram. And for me, it's like, no, I want to see the artwork. I want to experience the artwork. But it's got its role, you know, mm-hmm. and I think if used cleverly and as a business tool, it can be incredibly empowering. And especially for emerging artists, I think it's so important that you give yourself that power and that freedom to speak to the consumer and the viewer and the collector directly. You can tell them what your art is about, why you've done it, you know, what's the context of the piece. I think that's incredible, man.
Because I agree, it's a double-edged sword, and so much has come out of it. But something, a trend I'm noticing as of late, is where, you know, in the beginning we're talking about art speak. Mm-hmm. I'm finding, at least in the things that I'm looking at, people I'm talking to and seeing, that art speak is being overrided by what I would just call advertising speak. Mm-hmm. I no longer hear the word, or not no longer, I'm exaggerating, but more and more I hear the word content replacing art. I hear, you know, now I can't think off the top of my head, but, you know, there's all this advertising speak, mm-hmm. that artists are talking, you know, now batch workflow content, you know, content creator,
yeah.
These type of things, which in my opinion, I think are a very negative thing. I think words hold a lot more power than we want to give credit to.
Yeah.
It changes the way you see things. Have you noticed that? And what do you think about that? Because again, your background in advertising, these are things you're very familiar with, branding,
yeah.
You know, whatnot.
I think that...
Do you see that creeping in as much as I do?
Absolutely. I think that the world is becoming lazier. The world is becoming more and more about instant gratification. So if mm-hmm. I had to speak about my art on an Instagram post, it would be a lot of stuff that I talk about. And I think people just, especially on those kind of platforms, they just don't have the time or the inclination to sit and read your process or why you did a piece of work. So I think it is, I think, harmful to, in that sense, to art, because I agree with you 100%. The fact that if you can take somebody through a process of why you've created a specific piece or a body of work and explain it to them properly, that would empower them so much more as well to understand where you're coming from. But everything's become like bite size, you know, it's like a sound bite. It has to be mm-hmm. quick. It has to be fast. If you're not catching somebody in like, what, 2-3 seconds, they're gone. They're not interested.
Right.
You know? So in that sense, I think it's doing the art world a disservice. And as we were saying earlier, even though there's a lot of pretentious you know, mumbo jumbo out there, there's also a lot of power in understanding, truly understanding where an artist is coming from or what the work is about. And I think, yeah, I don't think that these social media platforms are doing that any justice. I mean, especially if you look at things like Twitter, what's the point? You know, it's like you can't explain something on that. Yeah, it's so condensed and so quick. And I don't know if it's going to change anytime soon. I think it's going to get worse. So
I think you're correct. Yeah, I agree.
So is it a good thing?
It's a long storm ahead.
Yeah, it is, you know. It's like you better, hang on. But the thing is, I mean, is it bad? Is it good? Is it, I don't know, because the world has changed so drastically in the last 10 years with the way we communicate and the way.
Yeah, it's exponential.
You know, and I don't know, is the art world going to change? I mean, how do you think? Do you think that social media and Instagram and those kind of platforms, do you think that they are essentially going to change the art world as we know it, as in the bricks and mortar gallery space where, because the way I always explain to some people when they ask me, like, why are you on Instagram? I go like, well, obviously for the obvious reasons, to exposure and get my work out there. But at the same time, the guy that is 24 years old now and following me might not have the money to invest in my art now, but in 15 years' time, he's going to be a guy with disposable income. And if I am then still one of his favorite artists or people that he like or that he's grown with, then he might very well be in a position to buy art. So maybe there's a long-term goal in here as well, that, you know, that you're investing time now and maybe the benefits will only come in 10 years' time. I have no idea. I don't even know if Instagram is going to be around in 10 years' time. I mean, who knows? I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you think the art world will be affected by this? Do you think it'll be changed by that?
Absolutely. I mean, it already has, right? We're seeing galleries are closing faster and faster. I mean, recently I was talking with a few gallery owners and they were saying in 5 years, they won't be surprised if half the galleries are gone.
Wow.
And that's coming from an informed perspective. I personally, I mean, I hear that a lot when people say, like, you know, what's going to be the next platform? Instagram can't last forever. I agree, but I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I think it's got a good long time in it, 5 to 10 years, possibly. Because, I can't think of another better way on the internet or on your phone to experience art. Like, what could replace that? All we're doing, it's an image.
Yeah.
So this is the best platform for experiencing an image.
Yeah.
Again, the thing that I think that's going to really change, and I don't know how I feel about it, is artists becoming advertising agencies. I think it has a really detrimental effect on the art, at least that I experienced. When you view what you create as content, the word content, it changes the way you view it and it changes the way you produce it.
Sure.
And I think it becomes a little bit more vacuous and vapid in a sense. Like I remember learning years ago, I used to teach in where I was teaching, I was on the same floor as the advertising agency department. Sorry. I'm on a lot of antibiotics right now and they're messing with my head. So I don't have a very clear, I've had a chest infection for like a month. And I remember learning, like I was talking or sitting in on a class once and they were talking about, you know, that thing about commercials. They're like our commercial is the product. It's the thing people should be watching. The program is, what do they call it? Filler.
Mm-hmm.
And that mentality, I mean, that still sticks with me and that's what I start seeing happening with art. So that's kind of the danger to me because the galleries, I'm one of the few, at least that I know, that really still see a lot of value in galleries. Mm-hmm. Most artists I know of are just like, I can't wait for the gallery to die.
Really?
And
wow.
Yeah, that's been my experience. And I don't agree with that at all because, you know, with artists, it's a lot of that 50-50 thing. Uh-huh. They're taking half my money. And while I agree there's a conversation there to be had.
Yeah.
Is that 50-50 still worth it? I think we don't think about sort of the more granular things like the gallery taking care of all your promotion for you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's such a healthy thing for artists to do that. It's very empowering. I can put my work out whenever I want, but how do I view it?
Yeah.
Am I viewing it as content? So that's why these words really disturb me when I hear people talking about my brand, the content I produce.
Yeah.
Like, man, no, you're an artist.
Yeah.
Quit using those terms. So for me, that's the big change.
It's a, yeah.
Sorry.
No. But I think what you say has got an incredible value there, because it's quite scary when you say that a lot of artists can't wait for the gallery to die, because I think there's a place for both. And I think they both have a job to do. And I agree with you about the terminology. And if for me, it's always like if you start creating work to get approval, or you start creating work to get affirmation, then you're not doing the work for the right reasons anymore. Then if it becomes a product, then the product's going to come with a whole bunch of expectations and things that boxes that it has to tick for it to be successful, because that's how advertising works. Who are you talking to? Who's mm-hmm. the target market? How old are they? What's the demographic? How much do they earn? Are they black? Are they white? Are they women? Are they men? If you start creating art with that in mind, well, then you are a marketer. You're not an artist anymore. And I think that is the danger of creating work that's not, I think, not truthful for me anyway. It's not truthful. And I think, mm-hmm. to your point, the gallery to me is still, you said the key word, it's a place to go and view and truly experience the art. Because if you...
Right, yeah. You know, first and foremost.
Yeah, because so many times when I was, for example, when I had my solo show in London, a lot of people that follow me on Instagram came through, and it was amazing to meet them, and we chatted about my work. But it was the first time that I could have a one-on-one, face-to-face conversation with somebody about my process, about my work, what it's about.
Wow, that's crazy.
And it was so humbling, and it was so amazing to... I mean, I spoke so much that night. It was like my throat was sore at the end of the night, but I didn't mind it because it was an opportunity for me to actually, you know, this word engagement. Now, that's engagement. When you can stand in front of someone, they can ask you questions and you can answer them out of your own, it comes out of your mouth. You can look them in the eye and go, this is why I did this. This is where this comes from. And so many of them were so surprised to kind of go like, wow, your works are so big. And I'm like, well, did you not read the description on Instagram that it says 1.8 meters by 1.5 meters? You know, they're like, yeah. So that just gave me context where I was like, oh my God,
yeah.
People don't pay attention. They don't. They just, they get there and they go, but they're huge. And I'm like, yeah, but you should know that because I wrote it down. It's like, I'm trying to give you an idea of how big they are. So that's where galleries come in. And I think that's the value still of galleries. And to go and see the work, like see the Bacon work up close, you know, and see Picasso up close and see mine, your work up close. Instagram can never, ever, in my opinion, it can never fulfill that gap. I don't care if you have virtual reality galleries. It's not the same. You know, until they bring out virtual galleries where you can like touch the painting and really feel the texture or smell the paint, until that point, it is just a visual representation of something that is completely different. It's not the same thing. So I hope and pray that galleries don't die out, because I need them. Because how else are people going to see the scale and the size and the paint strokes and the mistakes? How are they going to see that if they just look at it on a pixelated little image that's like, you know, 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters? I mean, it's not going to move
people. And I find that that's interesting on the topic of scale, because even prior, again, to things like Instagram, I always found scale to be the one of the last things that artists considered in creating their work. What role does scale serve for you?
Freedom. It just gives me a lot more freedom.
Interesting.
Yeah, I can't work small. I did a thing a couple of years back I got invited to do work for a charity, and they said to me like, okay, this is the format. And it was a paperback book. And I was like, what am I supposed to do with this? And it was so small because one brush stroke and it's like, I've covered the whole fucking page. I was like, what am I
done?
I call this black line. You know, it's like, what am I supposed to do with this piece of paper? And it was interesting because it forced me to use a pencil and other things. So that was an interesting challenge and I enjoyed it. But for me, the big canvas is what it gives me. It gives me just freedom because I can paint, I can dance, I can scratch, I can jump, I can do all of those things to express whatever I need to express. And my paintings seem to, because I started off a little bit smaller, it was kind of like a meter by 1.2. And that's why I want to extend my studio as well, because I want to go even larger. I want to get the scale bigger and bigger, because it just, yeah, it just allows me to whatever emotions are there that I can just express and paint with absolute openness and no restrictions. And the first time I did it, I was petrified when I got a canvas that was 1.8 meters tall. I thought it was the proverbial...
It's daunting,
yeah,
huh?
It was the proverbial blank canvas. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah, yeah. How do I do this? Yeah. How do I navigate this?
That's the thing. How do you navigate? Where do you start? Where do you put the first stroke? And then once I put the first stroke down and I started painting and I got out of my head and just painted, it was actually from there on, it was easy and simple. And funnily enough, those are the ones that sell the best, the big ones. The smaller ones, for some reason, what I've heard from Nadia Arnold, who represents me in London, she said, like, the smaller works people kind of walk past, but the bigger ones, because they're imposing and because they make a statement, it stops people in their tracks.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and they, and also there's this weird perception, which I think I find so weird, is that if you charge, for argument's sake, 100K for a painting that size, people are like, yeah, I'll paint that. I'll gladly pay that. But if it's a third of that size and you charge the same price, people get like all shirty about it. They're like, oh, but it's a small painting. So there's this weird perception. I don't know if that's like that in Europe, and I would love to hear your opinion on that, because in South Africa, it's pretty much size matters. So if a painting is bigger, then he's got to be a serious artist. If the painting is smaller, then it's like, ooh, is this guy still starting? Is he not quite established yet? So it's a weird thing how people also value art based on the scale. For whereas for me, I value art on the emotion it gives me, regardless if it's 10 by 10 or if it's a 2 meter painting. They're both going to have the same effect. It doesn't really matter. It's about that feeling. But funnily enough, when people have to put in South Africa, when people have to put their hand in their pocket, and Nadia saw that in America, and she saw it in London and in Bangkok, and not Bangkok, Singapore, people, the big ones are the ones that they want. They don't want the smaller ones. Do you find
So it's based on a literal quantity.
Yeah.
Like you're getting more canvas or more panel.
It's value for
your dollar.
Value for money.
Yeah. I don't know how that is here. It's interesting. You know, the thing is funny, in America right now, the trend is smaller works. But it's that's based on space. Uh-huh. Mostly people just don't have the space for bigger works.
Yeah.
At least out, you know, outside of the blue chip realm, which I, you know, it's not my world. Mm-hmm. Here in Europe, I don't know yet. I'm still trying to figure out how things work. At least in Paris, I don't think it has anything to do with that, with the size at all. It's interesting here is I think a lot of it, it's almost based on a brand than anything else. It wouldn't matter what size it is, because, you know, street art is still kind of what permeates, you know, the popular culture here. Mm-hmm. So it's more like who it is than anything else.
And how do you become who it is in Paris and in those places if you're not doing street art? I mean, how do you as John Vince, how do you carve your path to kind of go like, okay, well, I'm important. You should be looking at my work. Is it through galleries or is it just...
Ask me next year. I don't know.
Okay, so we're having a podcast next year this time again.
Figuring that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I'm still just kind of pulled back and observing it. And, you know, I do some mural work, but I'm obviously not in that realm. Mm-hmm. The gallery thing, I only have half my foot in it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think, you know, something that I have seen out here, what I'm very interested in is like doing your own shows, artists putting on their own events.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's where I think, at least in Europe, we're going to probably see a lot more of that. Mm-hmm. Artists seem to have a little bit more power here, because I think, I don't know if power is the right word, but that mythos of the artist, I think, is stronger here.
Mm-hmm. And how do the galleries feel about that? Because I know here in South Africa, when, you know, when I, for example, if I have private sales or people come to my studio, a lot of the galleries get very nervous about that, because they feel like I'm competing with them, or they should have a cut of it, or whatever the case might be. How do galleries feel about that in Europe?
I don't know. It's something that doesn't get talked about. You know, that's the thing that, at least all I can speak for is France, mm-hmm. where a lot of that type of business talk is not something that really occurs much.
Okay.
I can tell you in the US, where we're more open about that. And this is why I don't understand, like, artists, you know, like I said, are like shitting on galleries about this 50-50 thing. I'm like, well, have a conversation with your gallery. Like, I did that. I'm down to working. I pretty much just work with Hashimoto Contemporary now. And so we had a talk at one point, and it's like, look, it helps me to sell works on my own. And I definitely don't mind giving you 50% for things you sell. So we came to like a price range agreement. This price range, I'm okay to sell on my own out of my studio. Above this range, they'd prefer if I sell through them.
Okay.
And it's worked perfectly. And I still will sell more affordable, like, priced works through them. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been, in my experience, any problem. Like, people, if I'm selling something, you know, whatever, a few thousand or something on my own or through them, it doesn't matter. It hasn't affected. I haven't had the thing where, like, people will come to me thinking they can get it cheaper.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm finding a lot of, also proper collectors also understand the value of supporting the gallery. Yeah. Whereas, you know, you hear a lot of things about the undercut, like collectors going to the artist and being like, hey, can I get, you know, get this for 30% off where the gallery was taking 50. In my experience, that's kind of dissipating a bit.
That's good to hear, because yeah, I think that any,
yeah, it is.
I think it's any artist that sell their work for half price because somebody's come to their studio directly, I think is stupid. That is not a good idea, because even if somebody comes to my studio, I might give them, like, say, a small discount like they would maybe get at the gallery. But the artwork is still the price that it would have been sold at the gallery. You know, it's still, that's what it's worth. And that's what I'm charging for. Because I think when you start doing that thing of like, it goes into that weird advertising space again, where it's like, well, come to the studio today and you can get it for half price, you know? And it's like, well,
you're
almost like devaluing your own work by doing that, you know? It's like,
well, you are. That's the thing I find artists don't consider. You are literally devaluing it, because you're not thinking of your collectors as collectors. You're thinking of your collectors as consumers, and you have nothing but a product.
Yep.
They're investing in you. So if you have a $10,000 piece of work and you're like, okay, I'll sell it to you for $5,000, because you're like, man, there you go, I'm going to have a good month. Mm-hmm. No, you just devalued the rest of your collectors.
That's it. And if they find out about that,
and that'll hurt you in the long run.
Of course, because those guys will not come back. They will not collect and
invest
in you again in the future. They'll just go, well, this guy's a piss take. You know, why should I take him seriously? Because if it's about bargain hunting, well, yeah, then it's not about the art, you know. And I mean, I understand that some artists are in, like, difficult spots. You know, they need to survive. So
sure,
it's tough. I mean, I get that. It's a very, very tough thing to do. But what I also try and do is with some of the galleries here is I try to have obviously, like, integrity. So I'll say to them, like, listen, if somebody comes to me, the first question I always ask them is, like, where did you hear about me? Where did you find out about me? And if it's been through any of your social media feeds or your database that you have on your computer, or even if they saw my work in a gallery that represents me and then comes to me, then what I'll do is I'll split that with the gallery, because they've done the work to get that person into that gallery. The person saw the work there, and then I think they are absolutely entitled to that, and it's the right thing to do. But if somebody follows me on Instagram or discovers me through Google or whatever it might be, and they've never seen my work in any galleries, well, then it's my hard work that's paid off, you know, in the fact that people have seen my work around and about or whatever it might be. So I think integrity also plays, like, a big role in it, you know, to, you know, not be a shyster, you know, don't try and make a quick buck on the side, because you're basically biting the hand that feeds you, you know? And,
Yeah.
And I mean, those guys have got, like, great databases too. And I think that's where the gallery is also still very important. They have, some of them have been going for like 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So they've got a database
of
people that are serious about art, people that really want to put their hand in their pocket and go, like, yes, please, I want to own a John Vince. I want that piece, you know. Whereas, yeah, there's a lot of people that just, they're bargain hunting. They're just trying to, like, quickly get a deal here, quickly get a deal there. And I think that's where galleries for me are still, I don't have access to those people. And I don't, the truth is, I don't want to spend time that I could be painting and creating, trying to hunt down people that potentially could buy my work. I don't want to be doing that. I want to be an artist. I find it hard enough already as it is to manage everything, you know, because I design my own website and I write my own press releases, I take my own photographs, I do my own this. So I wish I had people that could do that for me, so I can actually just go into my studio every day, put on my music, and paint. I would love to do that,
right. You
know, because that's my true calling. That's what I want to do. I did 15 years of marketing and all that bullshit. I don't want to do that anymore. I'm not really interested. But for the time being, I don't really have a choice. I have to do it all because,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't have the resources to pay and that, assistance and blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't have that.
Right. Yeah. Something you said just sparked something in me is, and you said it a couple of times, it seems like music plays an important role in your painting process. And I was surprised, not too surprised, but your comment about My Bloody Valentine's Loveless, you're obviously knowledgeable because your comment was something not many people would say. As you said, it was one of the greatest guitar albums.
It is definitely. You know what?
Correct.
I'm gonna change that statement and say like it is the greatest guitar album ever made. I think.
Nice bold statement. Yeah, I like it
because, I mean, the sounds those people came up with and the production of it, and I've never heard anything like it before, and I've never heard anything like it since. It is, to me, that is, and I know the word genius gets used so much these days, and it irks me. But anyway, that to me was creative genius, that bit, because it was something that was so revolutionary and so different. And it's something that changed the way I listened to guitar music. And I'm sure that it changed a lot of bands and the way they played music as well. I think it's a genius album.
It started the shoegaze thing.
It so did. The shoegaze, you know, so true.
I mean, all those bands afterwards, and I mean, none were like it, but like you had bands like, you know, at the same time, like Cocteau Twins, Parts of Jesus and Mary Chain, Ride. I think Ride was a huge one. Swerve Driver. I mean, all these bands that followed in those footsteps.
I knew we were going to get along well when you said you were listening to My Bloody Valentine. Now you've mentioned
that was what I thought when you said that. I was like, oh, I can't wait to talk to him. We're going to be good friends.
I think so, John. I think this is going to be a long term friendship. I think so, because I mean, it's like you just mentioned the Cocteau Twins. You just mentioned Jesus and Mary Chain, and then there's like, you know, for me, bands like Sonic Youth. You know, like the way they did things.
One of my favorites. Yeah.
It's like, oh my god, you know, and now I'm going to throw in one that's a little bit different, but it's like the very first album before they became too self-obsessed. Smashing Pumpkins, Gish, that very first album when Billy Corgan was still raw and hungry.
Skalk, you're my favorite person on the planet right now. I've said those exact words. That album was life-changing for me. I've always said that album, and if you ever got into a lot of the B-sides they started to release post-Gish, were amazing. Oh, no. And then anything after that, I think, became self-obsessed and very commercial. That record, Gish, is so good.
Yeah, I mean, the drum sound, the Billy Chamberlain and the way he played the drums, and also just the way he played the drums, and then the drum sound they got in that was something we'd never heard. And here's a bit of like back history on me. At the time, I was in a band, and when Trevor, our bassist, when he played that album, we just sat down and listened to it for like nonstop for like an hour or two, and like played it over and over because it had such a different sound. And it was, I guess it was the precursor to like grunge in a way, but it was, to me, it was much more evolved than that. It was sophisticated. His guitar playing was phenomenal. So music in my life, music has always played like an essential part in I actually think my creativity in general, because Kiss was the first band that showed me it's okay to be different. So now if you can imagine, if you can imagine like in 1976, living in a conservative community, Christian parents, Christian upbringing, they give me money for Christmas. I go like, go and buy yourself an album. And the first album I bought was Kiss Alive 2. And I still have that album. It's full of sellotape by now.
Oh, that's a great album. Yeah, I have that on vinyl.
And my parents looked at this and thought, oh, help us, baby Jesus. What have we? Well, who is this kid? Why that album? You know, Gene Simmons and the Bloods running down the face and the whole thing. But they were the first one to me in that oppressive state of South Africa at the time to show me it's cool to be different. It's cool to do things differently, look different, try different things, play different music. So actually since then, music has always been like essential in like when I work and when I paint as well. I love music. I love interesting music. I like different music. I love music that's pushing the boundaries. You know, I love Bjork and I love Tool and I love, but then I'll, when I'm painting, it's like people often say to me, so what do you listen to when you paint? And I go, well, in this painting, there's a lot of ABBA. There's quite a bit of Jimmy, of Kenny Rogers in there. There's also a little bit of Johnny Cash in there. A bit of Slipknot, and then it went to the White Stripes, and the people are like, what do you mean ABBA? And I'm like, well, they're the greatest pop band of all time. How can you not like ABBA? What the hell?
ABBA was amazing, yeah.
I mean, show me anyone else that's written pop songs like that, you know. So, yeah, but music being such an expressive thing as well, and it moves me, and it actually influences my paintings quite a lot, because if there's a certain kind of music playing, I can see in my brush strokes and the way I move around the painting, it changes.
Yes,
you know, yeah. When I have like meditation music playing, then the paintings are a little bit more quiet. They're not as doesn't have as much movement and maybe sometimes aggression in it than when I'm listening to like a Slipknot track or something like that. You know, so yeah, no, I love music. I think music is it's essential. It's essential. Do you? What do you listen to when you paint?
I'm the same. I'm all over the board a lot of times, but I found like I just started getting to the thing where I'll rotate an album and just trying for a piece. Like if it's shorter things that I'm only going to spend like, you know, a day on, I'll rotate one album or I'll put it like shuffle all their albums and try and just see if like that has any effect on it.
Okay.
But I mean, lately, man, what I was listening to My Bloody Valentine a lot. I really like this band, Russian Circles. I've been really into, I hate all these terms that come up, but like a lot of post-rock I'm really interested in. Okay. And like, I mean, my go-to has always been stoner rock. Like, I mean, I love Sleep, you know, Black Sabbath is probably my favorite band that ever existed.
Really?
Yeah. I'm really heavy, like metal, sludge, post-rock type stoner rock.
Cool.
High on Fire. So I go through all kinds of things. I'm the same, but at the same time, you know, I'll listen to Cocteau Twins or, you know, man, I can't believe I'm going to admit this, but one of my favorite vocalists is, Judy Garland. I'll listen to like Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Nothing wrong with that. Did you watch the movie? Like, did you watch the recent movie on Judy with played by
which
Renee
one?
Zellweger's version of like,
oh, that, no, I haven't. Yeah, I haven't.
It's,
is it good?
It's going to blow your mind. It's going to blow your mind.
Really? Okay. Yeah,
please go watch
definitely
it.
Definitely
on the
list.
Let's not talk too much about that, but it's like, but listen, hey, if you say Judy Garland, I just said ABBA. Okay. So when that, my street cred just went down by like 50,000 points, you know, it's like, what do you mean?
Man, I could always edit it out.
No, please leave it in. Leave it in. It's important. No, but it's like, again.
Oh man, you know what? Just on that topic again, something I've been really obsessed with is, cause I've been going back to listening to a lot of like, Sisters of Mercy, Skinny Puppy, things like that.
Cool.
And then, of course, Nine Inch Nails it eventually went to. But the soundtrack, like the Watchmen show that was on HBO,
yes.
Wasn't a big fan of the show, but the soundtrack is amazing. I listened to that a lot while painting.
Actually, check it out because I watched the show. The show was kind of like iffy. It was interesting, but it kind of lost me halfway through. I was a bit like, getting a bit. So I was actually I'm going to write this down. Watch it.
And I'm a huge Alan Moore fan, so I was particularly critical about it.
Okay. I'm going to write that down so I can check that out. But I mean, for me, again, with the music, you know, when people sort of like, when you say like, you know, you hate to admit that you listen to Judy Garland and stuff, that's, for me, that's the point of music. Music is supposed to, like art, I think it's supposed to challenge you, you know, it's supposed to break the boundaries. It's supposed to reflect the society that we live in. And it can come in many forms. It can come in hip hop or jazz or classical or rock or metal or pop or whatever it is. So for me, as soon as I find something that's interesting, it can be Justin Timberlake. And I'm like, hey, that's a cool track. I don't mind listening to that. Because it's that thing again that we spoke about earlier of like, if I close my mind to something, then how can I be expressive? How can I be creative? If I kind of go, well, I'm only prepared to listen to this, or I'm only prepared to look at that, or I'm only prepared to listen to this point of view, then surely as an artist, I'm going to become very one-dimensional. And yeah, I think I can't afford that to happen, you know. I come from a history of like one-dimensional behavior, and I don't want to go back there again. I think that music is also for me is a doorway to trying new things and trying different things, although Spotify like irritates the shit out of me sometimes, because they, once they, the algorithms pick up that you like rock, then it's like, hey, here's more rock. And I'm like, no, that's not how it works. I want other stuff. So I've actually got to make a conscious effort to go and try and find other things. Otherwise, they just feed you more of the same. And I think that the world is in a scary place where it's kind of like, well, if you like this, we'll give you more of it. It should be more like, well, if you like that, how about something completely different? You know, that to me would be a better algorithm to intrigue people, you know. And but yeah, it's about, I guess, again, about engagement and keeping people there for as long as possible.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that's across the board, right? The thing with algorithms is it just promotes like a type of homogenization. It's like, I don't want the same political view when I search for this. I don't want the same music. Yeah, right. It's like, I in as much as I like with Spotify, I do like some of the playlists. Like, you know, I'll listen to Sisters of Mercy and then it'll give me this great playlist. And it's like, oh, this is cool. And I might learn some new bands or whatever like that. But then that's all I'm seeing day after day. And it's like, dude, I don't want to listen to that every single day.
Yeah. You know? You don't want to goth up every single day. I mean, it's like,
no. Yeah. I did that when I was 15. Come on, man. but with politics, it's like, I can't get an opposite side of view now on a subject. I really have to search for it, you know, when I see something. And then I don't trust any media anymore. I want to do my own homework. But it's becoming more and more difficult.
Well, that's the thing. Is like,
and YouTube's the same way. All these algorithms, just the same thing over and over again.
And you watch one clip of like Conor McGregor fighting, and the next day you've just got fighting videos.
Yes. Literally just did that because I had to wake up at 5 a.m. to see the fight the other day. And then I wanted to see some slow-mo clips. So I was looking on YouTube. Yeah. And then now it's, my whole feed is just Conor McGregor. I'm like, God damn. Come on, man. Mellow out.
Yeah, it was 40 seconds, man. Come on. That's all I watched was 40 seconds, and now I'm just watching that. So I was also like, be careful about what I click on these days. Otherwise, you just get the same of the same. Question for you. Do you ever get people – I get this question quite often. That when people look at your work, they kind of go like, how long did it take you to paint that? Do you get that?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
How do you answer that?
And of course, it's more, I think, in things where – I don't really know how to put it into words, but like if I would say like a similarity between you and I, like things that are very expressive, mm-hmm. that seems to be more of a common question.
Yeah.
And I think it's a way for one, I mean, of course it's multi-layered, but I think it's also a way for people to validate what they're seeing in a sense. Like I have to know it doesn't look like it was difficult. So I have to know there was time put in it.
Yeah. But people don't realize we're not plumbers. We don't work by the hour. You know, that's not how it goes. But I think you're right.
Right. Well, and also I think that the problem is too, they don't equate it. Like, cause I'll explain it like, even though it's an entirely different thing and I don't see myself in that light at all. But when you look at like a Japanese calligrapher, you know, what they can do in one stroke took 20 years.
That's it.
So if you're paying $10,000 for that one stroke, you're paying for 20 years. You're not paying for 20 seconds.
So true. That's actually a great way to describe it. I think I'll use that the next time if you don't mind, because that's always the thing, you know, it's like people.
No, all yours.
Yeah, because people always want to equate, you know, like time to money. And it's the same thing as the scale thing, you know, it's like, oh, well, if it's big, you know, you used a lot of paint and therefore a lot of time. So that must be worth something. And it's like, no, that's not quite how it works, you know. Okay, that's cool to know, because I always like struggle when people ask me that question.
You get that a lot?
I do get it because of my work being quite expressive, you know, and there's a lot of like loose movement and brush strokes and charcoal and things in it. I think people kind of look at it and they think, well, that looks like you did it in 10 minutes. And it's kind of like, no, that's not cool.
Right.
That's not quite it. But then they want to equate the 10 minutes to time, which equates to money, which equates to value. And so it's a frustrating question. I understand why people are asking it, because they don't know. But then I'm always mindful to not come across as arrogant, to kind of go like, well, you're actually paying for my interpretation or for my expression. That's what you're paying for. Because people will just be like,
which are valid, though. That's true. But it's like, how do you voice that without sounding like a pompous ass?
Exactly, because you just sound like a pompous ass when you say it. People are like, who do you think you are? You know, it's kind of like, but that is technically what you're paying for. It's like something comes to me in my head or while I'm painting. I have the ability to express it in the way that you seem to like. But you're paying for that. You're not paying for the paint or the frame or the canvas. That's not really what you're paying for. You're paying for something else, that is something that is not tangible. It's not a thing that I can kind of break down for you in hourly rates and go.
That's a great way to put it, man. It's intangible. Yeah.
That's difficult. But like, yeah, like you say, I don't want to come across as like an arrogant asshole. That's kind of like, do you know who I am? You know, it's like.
Yeah. Is that because I didn't realize until, what was it, back in November, we have a mutual friend in Dan Nopin.
Yep.
You're friends with the Art House Holland guys. And you're going there soon,
I'm
right?
I'm leaving on Monday evening. I'm on my way there. It's freezing cold. So I've got to go get myself some overalls before I go over there because it's really cold there at the moment. You got the summer stint.
Yeah.
I'm getting the winter stint. It's a wonderful thing. Again, this is like the beauty of like a positive thing about Instagram is Don and I started probably about two and a half years ago. We started liking each other's work and then we started chatting. That led to WhatsApp and we started talking on, you know, video calls and stuff like that. And we've been threatening to like do this thing where I go over there or he comes here for such a long time. And then I think just when I came back from my solo show, I said to him, what about Feb? I think it's time. I just need to come over there because I also feel like I'm in that point in my career right now where I want to be with some other artists that just think differently, that do things differently, because Don and my work couldn't be further apart. I mean, it is chalk and cheese. It's so far apart from each other. Yet there's like massive like mutual respect for each other's work and for what we do. So I'm so keen and I'm so excited to go there with him and Daniel and Santiago is the other guy who I've never met, so I don't really know him.
Yeah.
So I'm so excited. I'm going to be there for about, I think, 10 days. It's going to be a short trip, but I just want to go there to take in, be open, have fun, do different things, be in a different environment, a different studio, a different country. So I think it's going to be awesome. I'm going with no expectations. And I'm not going in there to kind of go like, well, I have to create 10 pieces of art that I can then come back and sell here. For me, it's just I want to go and hang with other artists and just see how they operate, you know, how they think about life, how they think about art, why they do what they do. I think it's going to be good for me to go and do something like expand the mind, you know, just learn new things. And
definitely, yeah.
And I'm sure that they can.
And you're going to be at the Art House, right?
Yeah, I think we're going to dance it something about Fluctuating or being between the Art House and. Is Art House the one in Leiden? Is that the one that's on the farm?
Yeah, that's in Leiden.
Okay, so I think we'll be between that and the studio. I think that's in Amsterdam. I think there's another spot that they've got there.
That's where Dan lives, is in Amsterdam.
Oh, okay. So. But yeah, I'm very excited about that to just go and try new things. And I know. Now, listen, I want to ask you a question or two about your work. So tell me about your process. First of all, how long have you been painting? How long have you been professional, full-time artist? Or has this been forever, like always been like that?
No, I think I've been doing this as a full-time gig about 7 years now.
Okay, so you and I have got the same time frame.
And we're about the same? Full-time? Nice. Yeah. Yeah. So it's still, I mean, it's nice because if you take it from a business standpoint, you cross that 5-year mark. So that's a very hopeful thing. But at the same time, man, there's so many things. I mean, you probably experienced too that come up. Like, I mean, now I'm in a period of like reflecting on the work and trying to find a balance between the work and commerce and what I think is authentic and all these things that I never really considered in the beginning. You're always so concerned with putting work out there, selling it, paying bills.
Yep.
And now like once you kind of plateau in that you achieve that, then I think more internal questions come up.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I'm dealing with at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's quite a weird thing when you, like you say, when you reach that sort of like 5-year period. So you kind of go like, okay, well, I must be doing something right because I'm still alive and I'm still selling art. So it's a good thing. That's fantastic. Because I'm also at that kind of crossroad right now where I have to start thinking, what are the next steps? You know, where do I want to go with my work? You know, do I want to be in like the Whitehall galleries? Do I want to start bringing in different things like, you know, my sculpturing that I started playing with last year, which was so much fun. I couldn't believe how much fun I had with that because I've never done that in my life before. So that was like a Yeah, it was like being a five-year-old with clay again. It was just awesome to like do something that was three-dimensional and not a piece of paper or not a canvas. So that was so cool. But it's also just like, I think for me, it's the business side of things. And it's not the thing of like, because I hate that phrase of like, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? That's not it. It's more about how do I see myself evolving and growing as an artist? You know, where do I want to be? You
right.
know? Because some artists are very happy with painting, selling, living a good life, and that's it. That's yeah. what they've chosen, you know.
And more power to them. I think that's a great yeah, thing if that, that's where you lie.
Absolutely, you know, no judgment there. I think it sounds pretty solid to me. It's like, have a good life and paint. It's like, hey, that sounds brilliant. But then there's the thing yep. of like, well, do I want more? You know, do I want to like get my work into museums, or do I want to get my work into the more serious galleries, if I can call it that, you know, the ones that are like the highbrow galleries, the ones that, you know, at the art fairs are
sure yeah going towards blue chip
yeah or, absolutely you yeah. know, is that my goal, and how do I achieve that, how do I get there? Mm-hmm. So it's all these kind of things. And what does that mean for me as an artist? Does that mean I need to push even harder? Does it mean that I need to evolve more? Does it mean I need to take more risks? Does it mean I need to expand my repertoire to sculpting and printmaking and etching or whatever, you know? So I'm also like constantly thinking about almost like a business person. It's like, okay, so you've got a skill set and you've honed that after 6-7 years to like a certain place, but what's next? What do I want next? You know, because I don't want to just be like blindly painting and then like 15 years from now, kind of go, okay, well, I missed that opportunity and I didn't do that I wanted to do.
Yeah. You don't want to feel like a rudderless ship or something. Yeah,
because I mean, you also know, it's like you get through those times when you do feel like a completely, like you're lost. Like everything you paint is shit. Everything you look at is not right. Every stroke that you put down is dreadful. And I don't know if you have the same experience, but it's usually like those times when I go through that you have that epiphany moment where you do something in one painting that just changes everything. It shifts you and you do something sometimes.
Yeah, and I find those they're fewer and far between as time goes on.
Do you think?
But I think it's because your expectations change. Yeah.
But why, John? Why? Why change the expectations? Because I try so hard to protect myself from myself, basically, because I always say to people, create without expectations, and I try as much as I can to apply that to my own creative process. But inevitably, it creeps in. The thing where you stand back and you look at a painting, or sometimes even a painting that's been sold already, or someone that's hanging in a gallery, and I'm like, man, I should have changed that bloody color. I hate that color there. And then it's kind of like, let it go, Skulk. It's gone. It's done. Somebody loved it the way it is. So just let it go.
Well, and that's what I mean by expectation. It's not like I have a conscious expectation of something, but more in that it's like that you're at least for me, my brain, it advances far faster than my hands or my taste. You know what I mean? So it's now like you look at enough art, you talk to enough artists, my scope has expanded. Mm. So therefore there's an unconscious expectation that I should be doing something a little bit better. Yeah. So that's what I mean by expectation. It's not like I'm going like, I need to do this and achieve this. Yeah. It's like you're saying, like, I'll look back at like some past work and be like, wow, I can see how I've matured, you know, since then. And I do let it go. I'm like, that was me then. It's a historical document, a personal historical document. But unfortunately or fortunately, my scope has expanded. I've experienced more art. Now I'm living in Paris. I have a higher, maybe standard is the better than expectation, but the standard has been set without me realizing it, that I need to do something better, but that means I have to work harder too. Yeah. So now it's like, I'm less satisfied, or I have less of those moments of like, aha, or, you know, I achieved something I didn't think about, you know? And I think it's a good thing. I think these are the things that in all the arts that you have to traverse. It's like, you know, again, like I always visualize this kind of like Campbellian, you know, journey thing. This is the swamp you got to get through to get to the other side. Yeah, you know,
I agree with you 100%. I think if you become complacent in terms of everything that you do, you're happy with. I think you should put your brushes down, or whatever you do, if it's like your sculpturing or whatever it is that you do, I think you should just stop right there. Because I think that just means that okay will be good enough. And I had very high expectations of myself, mm-hmm. and I want to see that the work that I did in 2013 compared to the work that I'm doing now, I want to see progression. I want to see, and it's not even about like style. It's more just a question of, I know when I'm painting paintings now that I'm more confident in putting colors down. I'm more confident in putting brush strokes down. In the beginning, I might've been quite tentative. Now I just do. So I agree with you 100%. I think if we stop trying, or if we stop evolving as artists, then I think you've hit a dead end. And then I think you need to seriously sit down and kind of go like, well, what is it that you want to do with this? You know, where are you going? And yeah. It's less for me, it's less about the painting side or the creative side. It's more about the personal spiritual development at that point, you know. And that's something that I want to constantly keep on pushing as much as I can, that I want to be better. You know, I want to, you know, I look at your work and I absolutely love your work. And I look at some of the way you apply paint and the way you layer and you use color and light in your paintings. Now that's something that I don't really do that much of in my work, but I absolutely love that. And it's something that I want to push myself to learn how to do that. And it's not a question of like necessarily changing my style, or not that I really have a style, but my look that I have at the moment. I don't want to necessarily kind of go, well, I want to paint like John, or I want to paint like whoever else, you know. I just want to keep on evolving, yeah. You know, and learn, basically, I think is the thing for me, is I want to look at people like you. And that's why I'm excited about going to Holland, is I want to learn from Dan, because he's got a certain skill set that I don't have. And Daniel has got a certain mm-hmm. craziness that he, you know, stuff that he does that I'm like, wow, okay, that's interesting. I would never have done that. And I just want to learn from people, you know, and be a sponge and get as much as I possibly can into the system. And so I can kind of go, wow, that was interesting, because I wouldn't have done it that way. And that's awesome. That's fantastic. I think that's, for me, is the goal, to just keep growing, keep evolving, keep pushing, just for my own sanity, I guess, not for affirmation or approval or, you know, accolades. It's more just so I can look myself in the mirror and kind of go, you're doing okay, just keep going. You know, just that they are. That for me is so important.
Right. That's amazing, man. And I think that's actually the perfect cadence to end on.
Cool.
And we've been talking for a long time. It's been a great conversation, man. Thank you so much.
It's absolutely wonderful to finally put like a voice to the picture that I see on Instagram, you know, keep doing beautiful work, my friend.
Yeah, likewise. I'm so glad. Lo-Fi Sight and Sound Podcast is an American artist living in Paris, France, in conversation with artists, musicians, and filmmakers discussing context, the creative process, and studio practice. You can find us on all streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Also at www.lofipodcast.com, no hyphens. Please rate and review. It helps more than you know. If you can't rate and review, then please share this with a friend. Lo-Fi Podcast is recorded, mixed, and edited by myself. Intro music is also by me. Thank you for listening.